Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seats. A quorum is present. The first item of business is the approval of the minutes from January 18th, 2023. Is there anyone that would like to make that motion? All right. Representative Finke moves the minutes from January 18th, 2023. Any questions or amendments? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes from January 18th, 2023, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. First item we have on the agenda today, we've got a couple things we're going to be doing. We do have a bill, and then we're also going to have some information coming to us. So the first thing we're going to do is handle the bill that we have before us. It's House File 177 from Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen, if you'd like to move to the presenter's table there.
Thank you, Chair.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, please.
Okay, Representative Hansen moves her bill, House File 177, and this will go to Children's and Family Policy and Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Hansen. If you'd like to please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. This bill was heard last year, so this is a repeat for anybody who paid attention or heard about this last year, but I will give you some more information for folks who are new. HF 177 seeks to align how we calculate MFIP income for parents with disabilities. This bill is very narrowly targeted to address the technical barriers facing low-income parents with disabilities who are accessing federal RSDI disability benefits and who still struggle to make ends meet. As a reminder, parents with disabilities receiving RSDI disability have worked more hours and have earned more wages in order to be eligible for RSDI disability. Parents with disabilities receiving SSI disability have worked less, making them ineligible for RSDI until they work more hours to qualify. There's a disincentive to work more hours to become eligible for RSDI because RSDI disability recipients receive far less assistance from MFIP than if the parent stays on SSI disability. It's a little confusing, so feel free to ask questions if you have them. But as stated in a letter from the Children's Defense Fund last year, even though federal SSI disability benefits are fully excluded as income for MFIP benefit calculations, federal RSDI disability benefits are deducted dollar for dollar, which significantly reduces the MFIP cash assistance amounts. This means that parents with disabilities who receive federal RSDI disability will receive less or no MFIP assistance because they have more work experience. And in turn, this also means that the children of parents with disabilities are most directly impacted. Parents with disabilities who are striving to build their resumes and their work history are put in a really tough spot. And this bill has the potential to increase or restore cash assistance for hundreds of families in Minnesota who would already be receiving it if it were not for their experience in the workforce or their desire to gain more work experience. So just to personalize this bill a little bit, I'd like to give you a quick example of how our current statutes play out. A 40-year-old mother has been living for 20 years with a traumatic brain injury, and she has four children. She believes it's important to work, even though her brain injury makes it very difficult to do so. She's had many jobs over the years and has tried her best to keep up, but her disability makes it tough to keep up with the demands of a job. Nevertheless, she kept trying to find a good fit and didn't give up. During this time, she'd been receiving SSI disability, and by 2021, nearly 20 years after her injury occurred, she'd finally had worked enough hours to become eligible for RSDI disability. However, to her surprise, when she transitioned to the RSDI, she lost nearly all of her MFIP assistance, upon which she relied to feed, clothe, and house her family, particularly when she was in between jobs. The health impacts of life with disabilities ebb and flow with good days and bad days, which makes maintaining employment difficult, to say the least. These are some of the most vulnerable families in Minnesota, and it's imperative that we do our part to make sure that they are treated with the equity, regardless of their time in the workforce. We do have an amendment that I'll make at my next committee stop, but I just want to address it before if anybody has a question about it. We'll be removing some language from 2.28 M2.29 from the word received to unit. That was the same amendment we made last year, but I did confirm with the department that we'd like to make that again this year. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back over to you and my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. We'll go straight to the testifiers, and then after that, we'll go to questions and discussion on the bill. The first person I have is Ellen Smart. If you'd like to come forward, introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ellen Smart, and I'm a benefits attorney at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid Minneapolis, or I've been an attorney at Mid-Minnesota for 22 years. For the past month, I've been a legislative advocate with Legal Aid's Legislative Services Advocacy Project. So this is my first testimony. Thank you for allowing me to testify in support of this bill. I'd also like to thank Representative Hansen for bringing this bill and Representative Curran for co-authoring. So Representative Hansen already told you the story about my client, Yoshida. I'll add a little more. She was 20 years old, coming home from work. There was gunfire on the street. She was not involved in any way. Bullet came through the car, hit her in the head. After lengthy hospital stays, physical therapy, occupational therapy, she was left with a traumatic brain injury that triggered very, very severe depressive spells. As Representative Hansen said, she felt it was very important to work when she could. I want to talk a little bit about how her income dropped. In 2021, when she brought this to my attention, she was receiving $794 a month in SSI, which is the program Representative Hansen mentioned is for people that have not earned a benefit from working about 10 years. She was also receiving $721 for her four children, which is $1,515 a month. They weren't rich, but with MFIP and the SSI income and a Section 8 voucher, they were managing to get by. As Representative Hansen mentioned, she really wanted to work and actually did earn her way onto RSDI, which is the benefit for working adults. So what happened when she started getting RSDI is her income dropped from $1,515 a month down to $838 a month because RSDI was counted dollar for dollar. Because she worked, Yoshida and her children experienced food insecurity for the first time and started going to food shelves. Because she worked, she fell behind on her utilities and was threatened with shutoffs, which then in turn threatened her Section 8 voucher, so they were facing housing insecurity for the first time. So this bill would treat the two programs similarly so that working would not put our families in jeopardy of losing housing and being hungry. Thank you very much for your time today and really appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for, first of all, is there anyone else from the public that would like to offer any testimony today? Hearing none, I will go to members' questions or discussions. Do any of the members have any questions or any discussions they'd like to offer on the bill? Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen and Ms. Smart. Welcome to the committee. I think 20 years ago I worked with you when I was working at Hennepin County. I used to be one of the teams that went through the appeal process, so you were defending the clients, and I used to be representing the county at one point on many aspects of MFIP, and I'm glad that this bill is coming forward. I know many people may be confused with the process. If you're getting SSI, it's going to be a child-only benefits, MFIP. And if you're getting RSDI, that is treated as an earned income whereby it's counted a dollar for a dollar. Mm-hmm. And so there's an equity between the two programs, whether you're receiving RSDI versus SSI, based on the circumstances you find yourself. So I think this bill will fix that issue, and I'm glad that we're working on this. So thank you so much for being here.
Okay. Thank you. And then Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, will this require the individual's benefits to be recalculated?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Keel. I will ask the question to our team, but there is an automatic reevaluation that happens with all of our recipients of public benefits. So through time, this will obviously be reevaluated through that process. But I will defer to see if when we change from SSI to RSDI or vice versa, if that would require a change in reevaluation. Do you know?
Would that be Ms. Smart, or would somebody from the department maybe have that answer? Looks like we have somebody who might have an answer for us. If you'd like to introduce yourself, please, I would appreciate it, and who you're with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ryan Johnson. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. So as we make changes, I don't have the exact, this bill will have to require a fiscal note. So, and as part of that fiscal note process, there are changes to the eligibility systems, both for the Minnesota Family Investment Program and the Child Care Assistance Program. So those changes to those eligibility systems will take a period of time to go into effect. And then once those changes are into effect, then the disregard that's in place, or that they're putting in place for RSDI, will go into place. So does that help answer the question?
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You must have read my brain. I'm just wondering now, so does this create a gap, or I mean, is that what is this going to be, a smooth transition, or will there be a time lapse? It's probably got to be developed yet, but
Mr. Johnson,
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it will be. We'll do our best to make it as smooth as possible in terms of making those changes, so that that we don't, you know, leave anybody in the middle of either either situation. So there'll be a kind of a clean break between how, when we count this income the way we count it now, and then making that change when those changes are made to the eligibility system, that will be, you know, effective on a certain date, and we'll communicate that to our county and tribal partners.
Representative Keel.
Thank you.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving me another opportunity. Mr. Johnson, I think I've got a quick question. How many participants will be impacted by this change?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Noor, it's about 2.4% of the MFIB caseload that currently receives RSDI income, and that's when we did this, when we looked at it previously, out of about 29,000 cases, that ended up being about 700 cases or so.
Representative Noor.
Just as a follow-up, so part of the process for doing the recertification, everyone has to do the annual recertification, and we verify that through the Social Security to determine their SDI and SSI. So this will follow the same process, and making sure that we don't burden people with so much information. Is that correct, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair and Representative Noor, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Noor. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. Quick question. So RSDI, we're talking RSDI for the parent. Would this also exempt RSDI income for the child in like a survivor situation where maybe one parent has passed?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair, Representative, that's the way that we understand the bill, is that the assistance unit, anybody in the assistance unit who receives RSDI, okay, then that would be excluded up to the maximum for the SSI for that same family size. So,
okay, I just want to make sure, because typically when we're talking RSDI on a child, we're talking that as the child's income, so it factors into the child's INFIP case, you know, whether the child's living with the parent or not. So I just want to make sure that we've got the language so that it's not counting whether it's child or parent.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's correct. We count the RSDI for the assistance unit now, and we would exclude the same RSDI for that same assistance unit. Yep.
So thank even you. If the child moved to a different assistance unit, so let's say a child's getting RSDI, deceased parent in the home is disabled, child is moves to a different family where family does not receive INFIP, so we're looking at a child-only case. In that scenario, would the RSDI count against the child-only case, or would it also be exempt?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair and Representative, I believe in that case it follows the person that's receiving the actual RSDI. So,
perfect. Yep. Thank you.
Representative Hicks, anything else?
Nope, that's what I wanted to know.
All right, taking a look, I do not see any other hands up for questions or discussions. Representative Hansen, would you like to offer closing comments and renew your motion?
I would, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to renew my motion to refer this to the Children and Families Policy and Finance Committee. And I'd also like to just say thank you. Thanks for hearing this. Those of us who were on the committee last year, for hearing it again. So thank you for bearing with us. And thank you to the department and to our testifiers. This is a complex issue. And so I'm hoping that we were able to present this in a way that helps you understand why this bill will help families and especially the children of parents with disabilities. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of re-referring House File 177 to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. House File 177 is re-referred to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Hansen, and to our testifiers.
Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome. Our next item is a presentation from the Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health, also known as MARCH. They're going to give us an idea of what the priorities and legislative agenda is going to be. This is part of the education process to prepare us for bills that will be coming forward a little bit later in session so that we've got kind of base that we'll be working from. Welcome to the committee today. We have a couple of testifiers. Would like you to please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation. Not too sure who's going to start first, so whoever would like to start first, go ahead, and then we'll go to the second person that we have, whoever that's going to be. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher. My name is Brian Zervis. I'm a co-chair with the Government Affairs Committee with MARCH. I also serve as the Vice President of Policy Compliance and Government Relations for North Star Behavioral Health. And with that, I'll pass it off to Amy for her introduction.
Very good. Hello, members. My name is Amy Delwell, and I am the President of MARCH. And wanted to thank you for your time this morning or this afternoon. I know it's a kind of a precious commodity, if you will. To start out, though, I'd like to highlight a couple folks. Representative Baker, Chair Fisher, Representative Frederick, we have been so grateful for your championing substance use disorder in the years that we've been here. And just want to, you know, call that out because it has been immensely gratifying to work with folks that are really digging into the issue. And I really hope that the folks around the table, anytime you want to meet with us, we want to meet with you to learn more. So what we're hoping to do today is to introduce a little bit about who MARCH is, and then we kind of have some base setting in terms of substance use disorders. And then Brian's going to tee up a little bit of preview of a bill that we'd like to bring forward this session. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll begin the presentation.
Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. So MARCH is a professional association. MARCH stands for the Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health. And you can see that we represent folks statewide, so all 87 counties, through 11 regions, and then we also have a specific tribal representation. About 70% actually of our board members are women, and over 30% are representing people of color, communities of color through specifically indigenous and black communities. And I think that's important to raise because not too many years ago, it was very monolithic. MARCH represents about 2,000 individuals, people. You can see at the top there, there's 428 licensed treatment sites in the state. MARCH represents at least half of those. But in addition to that, we have others that come to the table along with us, like health systems, recovery community organizations. We have individuals like students, retirees, as well as individual clinicians who come to MARCH as a place to unify their voice, as well as to advance issues in the area of substance use disorders and recovery. MARCH is typically known for our advocacy and public policy, and so you might have heard of us through driving forward the 1115 substance use disorder waiver. That was something that MARCH drove in 2017, and it's evolved since then. We're also acutely involved in the implementation of that, And in addition to that, just recently we co-sponsored alongside the department and several other organizations the Shared Solutions SUD Summit, whereby we hope to have an action plan for you sometime in April. We had over 600, almost 700 people involved in that two-day summit. In addition to that, March is a big trainer and convener in terms of education. We put on a conference every year where 1,400 people come together to discuss issues of addiction as well as recovery. And, of course, we do other education and training throughout the year on a monthly basis for our members, as well as offering a spring training. We also are working to weave into the fabric of healthcare substance use disorder. And I don't think that we've actually found full integration as of yet. And I think that that's something that we continue to strive for. I put this slide here because often there folks that are new, if you will, to the discussion of addiction and recovery sometimes grapple with the language a little bit and how do we speak about this. And so a gentleman by the name of John Kelly, which I'll have a slide up in a second on him, he came together with some others to create what they call the Addictionary. And in that, they identify common terms in terms of addiction and recovery. And they also highlight in section if there's something that is kind of an outmoded language that's has some stigma attached to it, so you can kind of be able to navigate the conversation and language in terms of addiction. Now, I called out John Kelly earlier. John Kelly was with us last year when we presented the bill that Brian will overview. And he gave, and I'm taking some of his slides and content because I thought it was a good base level setting for folks. But I do want to give him credit. He's a Harvard researcher as well as the founder and director of Recovery Research Institute. So the first slide that I wanted to highlight for folks is really on the horizon of what addiction can look like and moving towards recovery. And from a clinical view, achieving stable recovery can take a long time. And that's really what the overview of this slide is showing you. So if you think about the onset of addiction, so you look at the very left corner of the slide, onset of addiction, a lot of times folks find 4 to 5 years where they are seeking recovery on their own, so self-cessation. They might be attending groups or something, you know, community groups or things along those lines. But oftentimes then after 4 or 5 years, they begin to seek help. And oftentimes that will be in the form of treatment. And you see here in those intervening 8 years, a lot of times people might have several attempts at treatment or treatment episodes, and 4 to 5 on average. And then you get to a full remission, if you will, and generally people see that around 1 year. And so that's counting about 13 years or so, and that is kind of the definition of a chronic disease. And I think that that's something that people do not really appreciate in terms of substance use disorder, that it is a chronic disease, and this horizon, if you will, helps you to understand that. I will make a mention about, you know, the 5 years post. It still takes another 5 years after you've had 1 year of remission, 5 years of a remission, in order to reach the general public's risk of a substance use disorder, which is 15%. So I'm going to move on to the next slide here. There's a number of factors that can enter into a person's experience whereby it might make it more difficult for them to enter into recovery. And so there's several slides up the several pieces that I have up here, but it's just to give you a flavor of that. So the bigger one in the middle there is looking at substances. So for example, opioids is a very addictive substance. and oftentimes increases the number of times that a person might make a recovery attempt, right? So other drugs, so think about benzodiazepines as another example, where it's a very addictive drug that can be intractable for folks. The smaller slide on the top, there's certainly a factor in terms of race, which makes a recovery attempt increase for people. People that are not married actually are people that have additional recovery attempts on average. And if you have a co-occurring mental health condition, even if it's just depression or anxiety, not to mention SMI or the serious mental illness, that also increases your recovery attempts on average. And so I'm not going to say here that you add one and one and one, right? But all of these come together. And what I'm trying to depict here is that in addition to just substance use disorder, there are other things that make this an intractable and difficult disease to grapple with. The last slide before I hand this over to Brian looks at kind of the horizon of recovery. And so on the left side, you'll see that it shoots out to 40 years, and we would love that and want that for everyone. But you can see there that things like quality of life, recovery capital, happiness, and self-esteem are all going up on the left-hand side, and that's exactly what we want to see, right? And on the downslope is psychological distress. But what I'd like to call to your attention is then the right slide. And what's mm-hmm. happening in the right slide is that you see in that first year of recovery almost a dip at about 9 months. And when I was showing this to some colleagues the other day who actually are in recovery, so I'm a recovery ally, but when I was showing it to some people that were in recovery, they said, oh, yeah, I remember that part and time in my life. In fact, I wanted to commit suicide, right? And so what's happening here is that people are kind of looking back after this last 15 years of their life and going, what happened? What did I do? And then facing forward and going, I got a lot to do, right? But if we can help them through things like peer recovery support and community supports and mutual aid supports, they don't have to be in treatment for an entire year, right? But they need to be connected to their recovery. If we can do that, we can help more people push across the line of 1 year and then to 5 years and then to 15 years. And so hopefully that's some good context for what we're hoping to do. We want to curtail the number of years that people spend in recovery, and we want to curtail the number of times that they attempt recovery. And with that, I'll pass it over to Mr. Zervis.
Go ahead, Mr. Zervis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Amy. So the March Pathways to Recovery bill, as Amy had mentioned, was something developed and introduced last session. Our membership is comprised of clinicians, people that are doing direct service with people going into treatment, leaving treatment. And a lot of what we were trying to focus on in this package that was developed last year, we got a few things across the finish line. Since then, we continue to work with our membership. We continue to work with the department on some of these concepts and some of these ideas to get them in a better spot. Ultimately, the buckets that we're trying to focus on is how do we improve the patient experience? How do we support workforce? Our counselors, clinicians, the people that are doing the direct services is, as you can imagine, very stressful, long hours, and a lot of work. And then the third bucket is service preservation and access. How do we make the system better? As Amy had mentioned, in short, what we want to do is improve or increase protective factors, and we want to reduce risk and risk factors. So part of that, there's a lot happening in the state of Minnesota regarding addiction treatment. She had touched on this 1115 waiver or demonstration project, which is an effort to move the state towards having meeting a national standard called ASAM, American Society of Addiction Medicine. So a lot of the ongoing work that we've had internally, we want to give kudos to the Department of Human Services. We've had a lot of good meetings through the fall, this past fall, November and December, in talking through our ideas, talking through some of their ideas. So we want to acknowledge that. So in working with Representative Frederick and Representative Baker, the bill ideas that we have, we're kind of breaking up into two chunks. One is the policy, non-budget, well-vetted, non-controversial ideas. I'll touch on those four items briefly. We're hoping to get those moving sooner, and then the other policy budget ideas or topics that need a little more discussion will be coming later. So the two parts on here, continuity of work for interns. Substance disorder programs utilize interns that are in training that in Minnesota. To be qualified as an alcohol and drug counselor, you have to get 880 hours of practicum or clinical experience in a program. So once that internship ends, those interns can apply for licensure with the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. But in the program, those interns have to cease operating as an intern, which means that they have to kind of close their caseload. So we had worked with the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, who licenses alcohol and drug counselors, on trying to identify this window of, these interns are working with individuals, they have a therapeutic relationship, but once they apply, they have to wait until they actually get licensed to be able to continue to work. So one of these bill items is this continuity of work, which would give a 90-day window. So an intern would maintain work in the program, they would continue their supervision, and things like that while they're waiting for their licensure to go through. The next item is providing current training for HIV training for staff. So there's a statutory requirement that all staff have to be trained on HIV minimum standards. So part of the direction is to have the content, have the department outline the content of what needs to be in that training, update the training, and then providers can use that to make sure that they're using the most up-to-date information on HIV minimum standards. The next couple items is, the first one is on withdrawal management programs. Withdrawal management programs are a medicalized version of detox. So the people that go into these programs typically are intoxicated or in withdrawal, relatively shorter lengths of stay. And withdrawal management programs currently have to have a health department license that's called a supervised living facility class B, which is for non-ambulatory individuals. There's also a Class A license, which is for ambulatory individuals. And where this becomes important is current programs that are in operation. If you have a building or a physical plant, to meet the Class B requirements, the hallways have to be a certain width, bedrooms have to be a certain square footage. So current programs that want to provide withdrawal management that may meet the Class A requirements, but not the Class B requirements, would need to have a significant capital investment in extending walls and bedrooms. And for programs that are currently operating, that would then mean they would have to close down programming for people in treatment to be able to do the renovations to then be able to provide withdrawal management services. The last item here is extending documentation requirements for what's called a significant event. Historically, that needed to be, quote, immediately after the event happened. Last session, that language was updated to be significant events need to be documented on the day. What we had worked on with clinicians is to be able to have this 24-hour window. And where this becomes important, if I'm a clinician and there's an issue at the end of my day, and you know maybe there's an argument or fight or something that happens, I would need to make sure I document that in the clinical record. Likewise, if there's an issue late in the day, say 11:30, there's an incident and law enforcement gets involved or someone goes to the hospital, even if a counselor or a program staff are really diligent, they may not be able to get that done by midnight on the day. So we're looking for that 24-hour window to be able to give the staff opportunity to appropriately document. The next set of items are kind of moving into the policy and budget items that we're still, going to have as a separate bill coming through. So the first one is individual counseling access post-treatment. This bill item was developed in the mindset that when a person completes residential or intensive outpatient, what Amy was talking about is this continuity of care. So as time goes on, the needs, the intensity needs in general become less and less. So for an individual needing maybe an hour of counseling a week or an hour a month, currently if a program is serving someone, they would need to have a treatment plan review and update on this weekly time span, which becomes kind of a paperwork burden and problematic. So this is one of the items that we had introduced last year. We're in discussions with the department on kind of how this could look. Reporting required by the commissioner. So this one, the substance disorder programs have to submit a significant amount of data to the state. Bain's data, it's drug and alcohol abuse normative evaluation system. All of that data that gets sent into the state, there's not an easy or meaningful way that programs can get that data back to be able to do compare their services to other programs, to be able to identify outcomes. Obviously, when someone leaves our program, we may not know, did they end up getting readmitted, end up in the hospital, things like that. So we would like to have the department be able to provide that data back to providers in a meaningful format. Flexibility in residential programs. So residential programs have three levels of intensity, high, medium, and low. Each of those levels of care, high, you have to have 30 hours of treatment in a week, medium is 15, low is 5. So for the services to be delivered, if you imagine a person in a residential program, programs have to schedule more than 30 hours. My program, for example, we have 35 hours in a week that we schedule, because we recognize that some clients have medical appointments or mental health appointments, or for one reason or another, they're not able to get to group and get to treatment. When those individuals fall below 30 hours in that week, that means that that impacts the ability to bill or be reimbursed for high intensity. So programs have to staff for the high intensity, but if an individual is struggling, whether it's motivation or medical issues or mental health issues, what we would like to do is to be able to identify, document in the clinical record, what are the interventions that we're doing with the individual to try to get them to group. Obviously, these people that are struggling with motivation oftentimes require more staff resources because of their struggling. So what we'd like to do is to be able to have programs be able to bill for and get reimbursed at that level that they're providing. Reducing hours in a treatment week, so in that 30, 15, and 5, more for the high-intense residential programs. There's language around reducing the number of required hours in a treatment week when there's a federally recognized holiday. So if you think of counselors in programs, typically because those 30 hours need to be hit, programs need to figure out who's the counselor that's going to be coming in on Labor Day or Memorial Day. So this would give those counseling staff the day off, so to speak. It would drop the number of hours required in that particular treatment week. And then the last part is regarding the co-occurring programs. So there are rate enhancements for substance disorder programs that fall, one of which is a co-occurring rate enhancement, which is when programs have mental health professional staff or a complement of mental health professionals, practitioners, student and interns, those programs get a rate enhancement per day, but the staffing requirement is the program has to have 25% of their counseling staff have to be this makeup of professionals or practitioners or student interns. The practitioners and interns can't be more than 50% of that 25%, which is kind of confusing. What we're hearing from programs, the ability to get and maintain mental health professionals and staff is a challenge. Obviously, the service is very important and needed, but to have that component of the staffing is a challenge. So what we would like to do is to be able to have the program be able to identify what the adequate staffing is to be able to meet the person's needs. Documentation relief for treatment plan review. As I mentioned earlier, treatment plans need to be reviewed on a weekly basis. So every 7 days, roughly, a counselor will be reviewing what are the services that were delivered, how's the person's doing, how are they doing, how are we adjusting. Many programs, long-term programs, the need to update that treatment plan on a weekly basis is not necessary, because in a week over week, some people, they don't make progress, or so the requirement to have counselors do that update takes about an hour and a half per client. So if you imagine on a caseload week over week, that can add up. The next section are on the budget proposals. So this one is a temporary rate increase until the rate methodology is implemented. In the 2021 legislative session, there was a directive to the department to do a rate methodology study for substance disorder programs. The rates that programs currently operate under were developed or implemented in 2011. Since then, there's been a 3% increase in rates over that time. So what we're looking at is over that time, or I'm sorry, having this temporary rate increase of 24% to be implemented until the rate methodology is developed and implemented. Obviously, the challenge in maintaining programs to be competitive in the field is of high interest. There's also the second component, the rate increase for direct care staff. So a few sessions ago, there was in the home and community-based services, there was this kind of the direct care rate increase, which this is modeled after, which really looks at ensuring that whatever the increase is, there's a dedicated percentage that would go directly to direct care staff. So staff that are interacting with our clients, counselors, nurses, technicians, et cetera. Last couple items here, replacing lost client documents. One of the challenges that people we serve experience, whether they're couch hopping or going from A to B, they oftentimes either get things lost or stolen, which includes birth certificates, driver's licenses, important documents like that. So one of the things when individuals are going to get these items replaced, that the fees to replace them would get waived. The last item here, transition support service package, post-treatment completion. Last session, we had this bill idea that identified funding for housing, funding for transportation, childcare issues. It was looking at how do we fill the gaps. Our internal discussions, our work with the department and discussion with Chair Frederick, it's obviously a pretty massive and complex idea. So what we pivoted to this session is to have a work group develop to be able to explore and identify kind of these categories of what are the gaps, what's needed, and then to come back with recommendations in a subsequent session. That is it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the presentation. It's very informative and covers a lot of things that we started on over the last couple of years and still showing the opportunities that we still have out there. I do know we have a number of people with questions. I have Vice Chair Frederick, and then I've got Representative Baker. So Vice Chair Frederick, if you'd like to go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that over the last couple of years that I've got the opportunity to work with you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Baker. I also just want to give a shout out to former State Representative Keith Franke. He was also a tremendous ally in this work as well. So he's not in the legislature, so you know I mean it because he's not here, right? Like, but he was great to work with. So I just want to put that out there as well. One of the questions that I have that Ms. Delwu, that you kind of talked about during your presentation was that 9-month dip. And a slide prior to that, you were talking about the different numbers of recovery attempts that people would have. But one of the points that you didn't make was how those two things may be related. And I was wondering if you could go into that at all.
Ms. Delwu.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Frederick. Yes, I see them interrelated because that is some of the things that we need to be attentive to when a person does get into recovery, right? And so all of those factors, inclusive of, and that's where part of this bill also includes recovery capital, right, is attending to that part of that person's need. So if we have, say, co-occurring mental illness, certainly we want to continue to make sure that that person is tethered to their medication, if that is what they're needing post, you know, in their recovery, and that you have someone alongside them. A lot of times what we found, like in the ED visits, right, is people are seeking medications, right? And so that's an area where we want to make sure that a person has access to those medications and is able to continue on the recovery path. You know, in terms of marital relationship, we're not going to force people to get married so that they reduce their you know, recovery attempts, if you will. But I do think that it is looking at that person's recovery capital. And that's kind of a broad term that looks at relationships that people have, and actually relationships that are supportive to their recovery. So a lot of times that can be they're having to separate from a community that they typically have been surrounded by. So, for example, I was meeting with a woman in Ramsey County. She was talking with a gentleman who has repeated into homelessness and back into treatment, and he said, I get lonely. And as he gets lonely, he then returns to use. And when he returns to use, then he ends up, you know, in treatment again. So we need to be wrapping around people with those that are interested in recovery and supports in recovery along those lines. I hope I helped answer that.
Representative Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you. I think you did. I just was trying to highlight too the fact that we've all seen people go into some sort of treatment, and as your presentation just outlined, that it's not a one-time thing. Mm-hmm. That there are, whether it is because of a nine-month dip, whether it's whatever the reason is, I'm sure it's as varied as there are people out there, the needs to put supports in place, whatever those supports look like, to try to reduce the number of needs, I guess, mm-hmm. for treatment, implying that we are putting a system in place that once somebody successfully completes treatment, hopefully it's a one-time thing. I mean, I think that would be the goal. Maybe reduce the need for altogether, I guess, maybe if you want to talk bigger picture. But I appreciate your kind of outlining that nine-month dip specifically in the needs for supporting people through their recovery journey.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick.
Ms.
Delwell.
I just wanted to add something to that I think, you know, I highlighted opioids as being one of the, you know, most addictive drugs, but I wanted to also highlight that alcohol is still, you know, largely what people are entering into treatment for. And stimulants are another thing, like methamphetamines are those are the two largest drugs in terms of where people are entering. And I think that, you know, looking also at that previous chart and going, we need to have something in place. So we have, you know, medications for opioids, but in terms of methamphetamines, we don't, right? And so there are some things such as, and we've talked about this with the department a bit, contingency management that can help a person who is using methamphetamines. And so I think that those interventions will help shortcut some of the repeat treatment episodes. So thank you for letting me share that.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ms. Delvo. Okay, next we'll go to Representative Baker, then we've got Representative Backer, and then we've got Representative Finke.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. And again, to our testifiers, Amy and Brian, great job today. I'm guessing if some of the first-time members here heard this, they heard about 2% of it because it's very complicated. And I'm just going to try to pull it back a little bit. My friend Liz Olson says I'm going to zoom out for a little bit here and just kind of a little higher level. And I just want to say that we've got a number of champions in Minnesota here. My friend over there, Luke Frederick, is one of them, Representative Frederick, who a number of us have worked on this issue. It's not an easy issue. The disease of addiction is ugly and it's messy, and it changes people who they are. What I'm excited about this year is to work on stuff that we can actually really get along with and agree to, because it's simple policy changes that you identified today. And Brian, the big part of this today was the workforce challenges. And if we can soften some of those requirements, 30 hours, hard 30 hours a week, if there's exceptions, if there's a holiday, folks, this is what really matters to people that want to get in the business, is if there's enough flexibility that we trust the providers to do the right thing. And sometimes rules and laws don't allow that to happen, but we can change that with the workforce stuff this year when it comes to this issue. So we've got to trust our providers. They need to be able to pivot and do the reporting the next day if they need to, when there's somebody just being admitted. They need to be able to make these exceptions, knowing they're still making progress. But if there's nobody there to help them, our drug counselors, then we don't have anybody to help them with. So this is a big deal. Brian mentioned ASAM. That's an important part of our work coming in, too, because there's some new standards coming in that we should be really moving towards, and I hope that the majority wants to move quickly in that. We've got very specialty treatment centers around the state of Minnesota, some that focus just on brain trauma, some that are co-occurring, some are very specific to moms that are pregnant, and we've got to be able to take advantage of this, of those areas, so when people are assessed, we get them to the right place first instead of going to the wrong place or the place that doesn't fit them as well. But these new updated guidelines are very, very helpful. So I just want to say there's some things here that I'm looking forward to working with Rep. Frederick on and bringing to this committee, Mr. Chair, especially because we're a policy committee. And I think that we should get our bill out of here to the House floor as soon as we can. Hopefully our colleagues in the Senate will be able to do the same thing. And just, one final thing, too. This year I put up a naloxone box outside of my office so that if anybody ever hears of anything around here, somebody's unconscious, just know there's a nasal dispensary outside of my office. It's free. Anybody can grab it. If you know somebody you want to take it, go take it home. I've got extra. But we've got a little red box outside of my office on the second floor. We need to have these in all the schools around the state. We need to have these in more government buildings. We need to have them everywhere, like the AED dispensers that we have around. This needs to be the next thing that we do because this medicine is life-saving. And it is something that we need to get over the stigma of having it laying around. Why would you have that? There's so many things that we've been working through. So I just encourage members to learn about this complicated issue. Some of us are closer to it than others, and we're happy to help you with this, but I just want to say this is our goal this year, Mr. Chair, and I know this is your goal too, and you're a great chair for this kind of an issue, and I appreciate working on this, so I look forward to getting something done in this area. And again, the March organization and Maritap and others around the state are doing some really good work here, and I hope that we can support them in this stuff. So thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, Representative Baker, and I want to say thank you for all the work that you've done over the last couple of years working together to help pull this in and for your work in the opioid area. I will tell you that some of the programs out there that you folks have helped initiate, the naloxone, et cetera, I know a number of places that serve people who are homeless where, because of that program, they've literally saved lives of people who've come in. So I want to thank you for all that work that you've been doing on that with Representative Olson on that. It does make a difference, and this is what we try to do here is figure out how can we continue to make that difference, taking a look at the policy side and also continue to take a look at the budget side as how can we do a better job in this area. So I will pause there, and Representative Backer, you've been on the committee for the last couple of years. I know you've got some things you'd like to cover, so please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and I know this is not an easy issue as an EMT. I see this firsthand when everything else breaks down. So as you shared, Amy, you are correct. When people get lonely, they get depressed, and they go into that reverse cycle, and they get on the streets, they call us EMTs in greater Minnesota. From your I have two questions. And from your perspective, would workforce right now be your number one issue for the providers, or is there another issue that that you are starting to see that, and maybe Brian, you are seeing out in the workforce, not workforce, but out on the streets, lack of other choice of words. And number two, I have came across over the years a number of programs that are very more spiritual focused. How does this proposal work with some of that? How do you guys partner up with some of those programs? So those are my two questions, please. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Backer. I don't know who wants to start. Would that be Ms. Delwo or if that be Mr. Zerbis?
I'll begin and then I'll have
Sounds great, Ms. Delwo. Go ahead.
Mr. Zerbis, clean up. So I think in terms of the workforce, if you're talking about providers, yes, they're struggling with workforce at this point, workforce burnout, and actually attracting the workforce. So we've been talking also a lot about is there a way to do some kind of tiered licensure or something along those lines to bring more people into that field. And we also have some things that have been done in terms of background studies, some work around background studies that I think will help bring people into the field that want to do the work. But I'll share the flip side of that, in that if we were able to curtail the number of individuals who have repeat episodes of treatment, that would also help, one, allay some of the burden on the workforce, right? But then two, only 1 in 10 people who need access to treatment and need treatment are getting access to treatment. And so we do not have a sufficient workforce to meet that need. So to the degree that we can help save lives and improve the quality of life for people, that I think is our goal. So I will say that, you know, there's kind of both sides of that. And in terms of improving that person's ability to shortcut their time in addiction and the number of times that they go into treatment, a lot of that does have to do specifically for our Medicaid population, is their access to recovery capital and social determinants of health. So I'll...
Mr. Zervis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Backer. And on the workforce one, we can do more with more. And I think programs and counselors are exhausted. I think the challenges of filling staff, getting qualified staff, keeping qualified staff is huge. And when programs lose those, that then draws down the program directors or senior leadership that are licensed to get pulled into the programs, which then impairs their ability to do, you know, strategic planning, program growth, open up new programs and things like that. To the second question around working with spiritual groups, the SUD ecosystem is pretty varied. So we have in our membership and outside of membership faith-based groups, programs that use 12-step that may not be faith-based. And I think the importance of the pathways to recovery, that there's not a right pathway or an only pathway. Many people find it through faith-based groups or spiritual groups. Some people find it through medication-assisted treatment, others not. It really, I think the value or benefit of having the eclectic makeup makes it better for Minnesotans to be able to find their path to sobriety.
No follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. Okay. Thank you, Representative Back.
Thank you.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Thank you both for being here and for your presentation. My experience in this realm is much more personal and less professional than many folks here. So I have two quick things. One is, when was the last time the HIV training was updated? I saw in the language that you're looking for guidance and an up-to-date model, so I'm just curious when that happened. And then in terms of the 9-month dip, what's the extent of the dip that happens shortly thereafter here, but takes off the right side of our graph? We can see another drop coming in here, and it looks like one. I guess the thing that I'm trying to get to and something that I think I would just like to hear more about is, like, we can see, if we pull out, we can see the trajectory, but how varied, what is your experience with the up and down nature of those indicators for recovery?
And would that be Brian Zervis or Amy Delwood that I'd like to start? Brian, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Finke, on the HIV train, my understanding from our membership is 2015 was the last time that HIV training was updated.
And go ahead, Amy Delwo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Finke. In terms of the next dip that's coming, I think that this is tracking kind of people's happiness, et cetera. And I don't know that we can completely attribute to, you know, any one individual about this is the factors, because it's kind of a population health you know, concept that we're observing here. But what we've been able to see through the general population is that typically they have this down tick that then goes up. And I do see what you're saying. There's a little bit of a down tick and then up again. That, I think, has to do with just the cycle of the disease and the cycle of recovery, right? And so you're going to have some ups and downs. You know, the left side, you can see that, you know, pulling out, it looks like it's all up, right? But there are going to be some dips. And I think that that's, again, where you're looking at people have varied pathways to recovery, right? And it used to be that people identified recovery as abstinence only. And people define that differently now, and they define it for themselves, period, right? And so I think that there's going to be some, you're going to see some of those ups and downs, and it has to do with people's varied pathways and that kind of the elongation of time, their experience of recovery. And if we can hold them, support them through those periods and kind of anticipate a bit about these dips typically come, putting in place supports at that time, like being able to check back in with your counselor, or like having a peer recovery support specialist walk alongside you to help you get to a meeting, or, you know, encourage you to get to a meeting. Those kinds of things. Well, I'll just say one other piece. I was having a conversation this morning, and we had a number of folks that we asked in terms of a peer recovery support specialist, did they help you from avoiding a relapse? And 60% of those that we had talked to had said yes to helping me avoid a relapse once, or helping me avoid a relapse three or more times. And so it's engaging those folks, not just treatment done, or, oh, you're, you know, 9 months out, you're good. It is a lifelong thing that you need to be attentive to.
Representative Finke.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you both for your answer. And I would just add that, you know, my personal experience shows that as well. And I just want to, like, reinforce that idea you said, right? Substance use, SUD as chronic disease, but recovery as well is just a part of that, right? So we're thinking through all of that in terms of what the recovery span looks like, and not just getting to sobriety.
Thank you. Next is Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. Thank you for all of this information today and all your great work. You guys have representing the counselors and 75% of the members. I would love a list of who is a member of your organization, too. I was just trying to find it online. I can't find it. But very supportive. What I'm looking at is, as we look at with baby boomer populations aging, if your members and if you're tracking the age demographics of where we're seeing after post-pandemic, you know, looking post-pandemic, if we've seen an increase in what those age breakdowns are, I'm just curious if we've just seen changes over the, as people are aging, if we're seeing more addiction, what that looks like, and how we're tracking it. I'm sure that you guys or DHS or somebody's tracking it, right? I just think it provides new complexities when we're looking at long-term care and the overlap of treatment and what that correlation will be for us, you know, as we look at the future.
Okay, and Ryan Zerbes or Amy Delwu, would either of you like to comment?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Department of Human Services, the DANES data I'd mentioned, Drug and Alcohol Abuse Normative Evaluation System, all providers put in information on admissions and discharges and ages and substance use, so they would be able to provide that trend data.
Mr. Chair.
And Amy Dell will go ahead.
Brian had referenced a piece in our bill about getting data, and so I want to add on and amplify this a little bit. We wanted to not only say the data that we provide into the state, that we can get it out in an accessible format. And right now, what happens with the DANES data is that you go run a report and you get a hard percentage. You can run it for the statewide, or you can run it for the one license. Or you, and if you want to look at more than one license for your own agency, you have to run it and
drop it into an Excel spreadsheet, mush it all together, right? And so what we are not getting right now, and we're kind of flying blind in terms of data. So that very simple question about whether or not we can see a trend changing in age, we can't. We don't have accessible data to be able to take a look at a simple question like that, or saying how many individuals are in our residential treatment that are working or not working, right? We can't blend just a couple of different data elements together to begin to tell a story. We just get hard percentages on some things. And so I think that you're tapping into something that we would like to see as well, henceforth some of the language in the bill.
Representative Mendelsohn.
Just thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder, as we are looking at our baby boomer population, which is going to be our largest yet, and like as somebody that has provided therapy, and as we look at these complex issues with aging and our shortages of staffing, is it going to make sense to have multiple services within some of our long-term care facilities, things like that? Questions that maybe we don't have the answer to, but appreciative of your work. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Amy Dell.
I will say on average right now, a person in treatment is about in their 30s, right? So that's the average point. So you do have more people that, you go into places and you'll have somebody in their 60s or 70s in treatment. But, I think that we certainly will see with the baby boomers, more individuals who are needing support in that regard, but I just wanted to kind of answer the question in terms of what the average is. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Mr. Zarbis, and also Ms. Delwell. I think the issue of the person-centered services, whereby you're looking at the unique needs and that specific needs for each person, at the same time looking into the support and services and wraparound services, that we often don't help those who are seeking, help from many providers for lack of resources and so many other things. So going back to the culturally appropriate services, also looking into the evidence-based culturally specific services, which has not been highlighted in some of the things that we've talked about. We've got specific Native American cultural appropriate services and different other groups. How are we planning to integrate that into your policy, whereby it's something that we can allow for folks who have unique needs, and specifically in terms of more cultural appropriate services for those individuals?
Amy Delwo.
Ready to go. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Noor. In terms of culturally specific, I think there's a couple ways that we need to look at that. A couple years ago, we had had some language pass around culturally specific programming to increase the modified rates that are allowed to do just that, whether it be to provide for a sweat or smudging or something along those lines that would be culturally specific. You used a term called evidence-based, right? And I think that's one of the things that we do need to look more clearly into our policies, because there are some culturally responsive programs that do not necessarily have the data that creates the evidence base backing for it. And just had this conversation actually at the Shared Solutions Summit, where you have a number of folks that are from the community that are wholly capable of assisting someone in their recovery. However, the work that they're doing does not necessarily have the $1 million necessary to have funded it with some sort of double-blind study that demonstrates its efficacy. And so I think that we need to create some space to relax some of those evidence-based requirements, specifically in culturally responsive programs, and then also apply some funding that assists those programs in getting some evaluation that would help them to demonstrate if that is in fact what the committee so desires, is an evidence-based practice, right? But they haven't, you know, it hasn't been funded in that way to actually have, you know, the evidence that it's effective.
Thank you. Brian Zerbes, would you like to add anything?
I guess, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the thing I was thinking about, in a March survey where we looked at the amount of time counselors spend in documenting is about 25 to 40% of their time. So it's not being direct with client or not spending time with clients in individual and group. It's not going to trainings. I think in thinking of the strains on programs to have the ability to bring in trainers or to send staff to trainers, there's a lot of these complex variables that make it a challenge, in addition to what Amy had said, for programs to have clinicians stay sharp, to find out what's emerging evidence. How can we, if we're going to take on in our program, to determine that our services are effective? That takes time, and it takes the right people in a program to be able to do that.
Thank you. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've got more work to do in this field, and especially when we're talking about cultural responsive process. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. And a couple comments I'd like to make is, first of all, thank you very much for the presentation today. One of the things that I have got a question I would like to make sure we connect the dots a little bit more on is that so often the way things have been in the past, you know, people go through treatment and then pop out they come with not a lot of thoughtful connected services that are available out there to connect people. And the reason I ask that is you're showing us a graph of how many times people relapse. Tell us a little bit, and I'm going to ask you to focus a little bit more, is it's not unusual that you may have had people who are homeless to start with. So tell us a little bit how more a responsive program or some of the things that you're thinking of building out here could help address those kind of situations, which in turn would probably help reduce some of the relapses. Ms. Delwell, I know we've talked on this in the past, mm-hmm. so if you'd like to go ahead, please, and then Certainly. We can go to Brian Zerbes.
Then I'll ask Mr. Zerbes to chime in. And kind of specifically to the bill itself, and it's now turned to a work group, but mm-hmm. One of the things that we had suggested is, as you mentioned, many people who are in our substance use disorder treatment programs have experienced homelessness prior to. And as a result of that, one of the suggestions that we had is that when they're leaving treatment, that we provide for a voucher of sorts or some sort of resource that allows them to be able to have a predictable source of continuity to their housing. And so that might be that they maybe found someone who is on the path of recovery and treatment, and they might go get an apartment together. And to be able to have that count, if you will, that they can depend on that for 6 months or 9 months would be extraordinarily helpful for them to be able to gain a foothold in their community in recovery. In addition to that, we also had suggested transportation. Many of the individuals that we are working with have lost their license due to their disease. And so, for example, in Duluth, the buses stop running at 7. So you can get to an evening meeting, but you can't get home, right? And so by allowing some resource, and that's not considered a medical appointment. So Medicaid does not cover the transportation to getting to a meeting when you're in recovery, which maybe that's another question we should be asking at this point. So I think that it's those pieces that need to come into play in terms of supporting an individual and for a predicted period of time. Did I get to where you wanted me to go? or where we've talked about in the past?
Yes, Amy Delwell, you did a good job of hitting us how these other things have a big impact. Is that so often when people come out, there isn't that support network. And I think your example of transportation is perfectly
a perfect definition of that. And also, if you take a look, if somebody's out in the rural areas of the state where you don't have bus service and they don't have a license, how are they getting to the appointments that can make a difference whether they relapse or not? Mm-hmm. Or how can they get to the support groups? And this is why, you know, as we started this discussion with Representative Baker, former Representative Frankie, and Representative Frederick, is taking a look at that whole wraparound. How do we do a better job? What are the things that we're losing right now? And how do we build that system out? It's like in the mental health system. Part of the problem is we've never built out the system, and we've built out part of the system in the SUD world, but we've never really approached it in the holistic way. And I appreciate the last year when we started these discussions with all of us getting together and talking about these other things that wrap around that shows how much more work we still have to do to put together a system that will eventually pay dividends, because when you reduce addiction rate, when you drop that down, you increase the likelihood of success, and that also then helps us eventually with the workforce, because when they're going through the repeats and falling down and haven't come up again, usually that also means something has happened where if they had a job, they're probably losing it or they're not quite getting to that point, and then that also helps with our workforce shortages in other areas. And I know those were some things that we talked about before. And Brian Zerbes, I'm sure you have some things to add.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add in on to have continuity of care, you need people to do that. You need good, competent individuals. Some of the services you're touching on, treatment coordination, peer recovery support, the unit-based reimbursement for those is $11 and change per unit for treatment coordination. I think it's $14 or $15 per unit for peer recovery support services. So in looking at what's needed and how to support people over a continuum, that's a challenge in not only hiring and retaining good people, but those folks also need to be supervised. Those unit-based services, you have to have a biller. You have to have someone trying to bill for it and then trying to work on getting claims paid. Oftentimes, the juice isn't worth the squeeze to chase after those units. Programs have staff that will do it. Obviously, we're going to support people getting from A to B and figuring things out. But I think some of those challenges with the reimbursement rates creates problems or some challenges for programs.
Yeah. Thank you, Brian Zerbes. Any other questions or comments? Amy Dale will go ahead.
I do. Mr. Chair, you had mentioned something about rural Minnesota, and I wanted to amplify this quickly, is that there are some treatment deserts around Minnesota, right? And so, for example, was with visiting with Vice Chair Frederick, and we were having a discussion about how far someone would have to go from that location to get to a residential treatment. And it was an hour and a half away. Or if you want to get to, an outpatient treatment somewhere else, it might be an hour and a half drive to get there. And so that is troubling in terms of being able to receive the services and supports that you might need. And so I wanted to amplify that. I know that we have a number of members that are in rural Minnesota, and we can't afford to lose any more of them, right? We do have some periodically that have been closing. Part of it is due to workforce, right? And so thank you for letting me share that.
You're welcome. Thank you. Amy Dello, thank you, Brian Zerbes, for your presentations today. I think it was very helpful to give us kind of a base for some of the issues that we're going to be seeing as we go forward. We will eventually be having bills that will be coming down on this issue, so make sure to follow up on them. Hopefully this will help as we process. I want to thank everyone today for being here. On Wednesday, we'll be hearing from the Mental Health Legislative Network, which will, again, help tee up some of the things that we'll be seeing moving forward. And part of this is also being done, too, because we know we have bills that are coming out in this area. The jackets just have not come down. So we're trying to get as much education done as early as possible so that when we start seeing the bills, we'll remember some of this and be able to move a little bit quicker when the bills actually come before us. But making sure we've got the time for the full discussion. So thank everyone, and with that, we are adjourned.